ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages. You're tuned to 90.7 FM, WGXC in Accra, or more appropriately, WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra. That handles the legal ID for our first anniversary celebration today, February 26th. It's 4 p.m., and we're going to interrupt our broadcast from the Catskill Community Center because we have a special guest here in studio in Hudson. Joining me, Ron Diamonstein, your host, and Shanika McIntosh working the board. We have Jonathan Myberg, a member of the band Shearwater, who will be performing tonight at Helsinki Hudson as part of a benefit concert, graciously allowing us to get a slice of the door. And I want to welcome Jonathan here.
It's good to be here.
Thank you so much for making the early trek up.
Oh, thank you. It meant I got to take the train up from the city and take a nice little snooze on the train. I kept waking up and thinking, wow, that's a big lake. It just goes on and on and on.
On and on and on, yes.
And I saw a bald eagle, too.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Yes. Well, you, of course, we can always talk about your identification of birds and with birds, yes.
It's just a fetish.
Yes. So the band is in the midst of a tour for their new album, Animal Joy. It's your first release on the Sub Pop label.
Yep.
You've previously been on Matador and I think a couple of other sort of minor labels at the beginning, yes?
Yeah, the training records were released on other labels, but the first one on Matador, the Palo Santo, was like the one I think of as our first real proper record.
Okay. So, in the context of the transformations that are undergoing in the recording industry, both on the both producer and I guess even the consumer side, mm-hmm. I was just wondering why did you choose a new label, and why did you choose a new label? What presented itself?
Well, our contract was up with Matador. We'd done three records with them, and they asked for demos for a new record, and I made some, and I was really excited about them, and I gave them to Matador, and they said, actually, we don't want this. So Sub Pop had been friends of ours for a while, for a number of different reasons, and I approached them with it, and they said, we would love to. So we just got a fresh start with them, which is really exciting. And thus far, I mean, we're still in the honeymoon period with them, but they have yet to put a foot wrong. They've been excellent.
Oh, that's good. So did you give any thought to striking out somewhat more independently?
You mean releasing our own albums instead?
Yes.
No. And I'll tell you why.
Please do.
I mean, because certainly, you know, in this day and age, it is easier to release your own music, you know, you could retain all the rights to it, you could take all the profits from the sales of it, that kind of thing. But what you can't really do is promote it yourself very effectively. And that, to me, is the real value of working with a record label, is all the promotion that you can do in print, in blogs, on the radio. There's that kind of support you really can't get. It's, you know, it would be too expensive for us to try to do all that ourselves.
Okay, that's interesting.
See the records as, I mean, I'm not likely to ever see any royalties, for instance, from the sale of this record. But as a giant promotional item for the band, it's very useful.
So it's still essentially touring.
Yeah, there's touring and there's, eventually you're sort of trying to build up your, I guess, identity.
Yeah, your brand.
I hate to use the word brand because it seems to kind of reduce everything to a commodity. But we live at the intersection of art and commerce. And I think if people understood actually how much it matters to bands whether you buy their record and whether you come to their shows, more people would do that than do.
Well, I brought this up because specifically of the Louis C.K. phenomena, the comedian Louis C.K. I'm not sure if you're...
Yeah, no, I know who he is.
Yes.
What's the...
Well, he recorded a performance at the Beacon Theater in New York, and mm-hmm. Instead of going through any sort of other distributor to put it out, he basically set up a website and sold it to anyone for $5 with, you know, unlimited downloads or whatever, and to basically put the trust on people to say, well, here it is. I'm only asking for $5, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm just saying, is this as a potential model so that you're not so much subject to the vagaries?
That's great if you're famous. I mean, this is why it works for Radiohead, because, you know, they can give away their record because millions of people want the record. So even if most people steal it, you know, or if the largest fraction of their audience steals it, the small fraction is still enough to make them a tidy profit. You know, in our case, We don't have that size of an audience, and so we're still trying to.
We're still trying to build
the audience, and that's why you need a record label at this point, if you're lucky enough to get on with one.
Yes. Well, you are.
But yeah, which, I mean, we're very, very lucky as a band. I feel really glad to be working with the people we're working with. But it is a strange time, because it never has an art form been so easy to steal, you know, ever. And so it's, in a way, it's kind of a rotten time to get into music. But as Gillian Welch said, you know, that we're going to do it anyway.
Yeah. I mean, and do you feel, though, that it's so decidedly one-sided in the sense of actually of stealing, or is there, do you see any sort of positivity in the sense that there is a more perhaps intimate engagement between you and the fan?
If, you know, you could look at it this way. If people listen to it and like it, if they do that and then don't buy your record, they're really hurting you. If they listen to it and don't like it, it's kind of no harm, no foul.
Yeah, okay. Well, then speaking of the new record, you've mentioned in other... Actually, this kind of ties into a couple of things. So you've mentioned in other interviews about the importance that you place on, I guess, an album's songs having a common purpose. I think you've talked about having all
like the
songs.
The album is a complete piece in and of itself.
Yes, and how I think you've mentioned, I have a quote from one interview I found online, about songs talking to one another, but I guess by way of sort of conjuring up a world that's peculiar to itself. And so, you know, in the context of this new world, I mean, do you feel that there's still a space for people to actually listen to albums as integral wholes, as opposed to breaking it up as iTunes tracks?
Certainly, things have become much more fragmented. And if you're trying to market a record, I mean, this is a mistake I made with the last record that we made. There were very few endpoints to that record. You kind of had to listen to the whole thing. And I think ultimately, that, you know, commercially speaking, that hurt us on that record. With this record, I very deliberately tried to make it a little easier to have these bite-sized pieces that you could play and market and enjoy as discrete units. But that didn't feel like a capitulation to commercialism or anything. It was just sort of the challenge of a different medium. I think you know, artists have always had to consider their audience and consider their medium. And like these days when you're recording your album, for instance, you have to think about the way that people are listening to it. Like, people are listening to albums not on their nice hi-fi systems. They're listening to them on computer speakers or in earbuds. And those things have very poor low-end response, and they don't do well with wide dynamic ranges. So if you want your record to sound good in those environments, you have to make it with less actual dynamics and with less low end. And in the past, I'd kind of tried to push against that and make records that didn't work so well that way. But ultimately, you're just hurting yourself when you do that. So this record, we deliberately tried to make friendlier in those environments. And this is nothing new. I mean, the old Motown records, they used to make them to sound good on AM radio, and they still sound great.
Yes.
Don't have much low end, though.
And I think some people have mentioned that you see it almost as a doing some sort of 360, where, again, the record becomes the promotional vehicle for the actual performance. It's the performance that, again, becomes, you know.
Yeah, it's like that time in the history of the world where musicians made records and then made money off the sales of records. That was just a little blip. It's like now we're back in the world where you have to be on the road if you want to survive.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, though, you have a situation where so much there's still this element of music that is mechanized, you know. I mean, you have it where a lot of people doing sampling or pre-recording or manipulating pre-recorded sounds, and so as opposed to simply just having, you know, some guy with a guitar or a couple of people.
The technology continues to evolve, and the creative engagement with the technology continues to change. I mean, we have, even in our show, which is, you know, an almost entirely live show, we have a few elements from the record that we trigger as samples.
Yeah, so I've seen a few on YouTube. People have recorded some already songs from and I don't know how
from
you feel.
Our shows.
Yeah.
There's a couple, you can't stop it. That's great.
Yeah, but it's an interesting introduction to seeing how you handle the new material live. And I mean, considering again, you're someone off of a not even a camcorder. It's a phone.
Yeah.
Right. And but still, it comes across pretty interestingly. I think I also, in this context of transformation and of different type of musical styles, it's other reviews have picked up on this, and I think I did, that this new album, Animal Joy, is the title of it, by the way.
Just came out last week.
Yeah, and we've got a copy a week ago, and we've been listening to it. Just after a few listens, it seems to, as I wrote down here, it seems to mesh a much more propulsive pop grandeur to your what's considered, I guess, a traditional Shearwater chamber sound.
Yeah. I mean, we made a few rules when we were making this record that we didn't want to have any orchestral instruments. Although we broke that a little bit by having a harp and also on one song a clarinet, but that the clarinet's being used to make a sound that's like somebody bending a steel beam in half. It doesn't sound like a clarinet. And we wanted to have the rhythm section be much more upfront. In past records, we'd aimed for a sound like the band was playing in a giant room that you were at one end of and the band was at the other.
Right.
And because I love the depth and dimension of that. But this time we wanted the rhythm section, you know, the bass and the drums, to be right up kind of there with you. I wanted the band to be much more present and kind of in your face.
Well, I found it interesting because there's this, I noticed a certain kind of similarity, slight similarity, but to the change. When Tom Waits left Asylum, whether or not there is a direct correlation, but from his Asylum period of music to when he went to Island Records.
Oh, yeah, like when he did Swordfish Trombones.
Yes, and a dramatic shift that triggered a different kind of critical reception for him dramatically. And I was wondering if there's something slightly, an underlay.
Switching record labels seemed like a real this seemed like a natural time to do that. We changed the artwork, we changed the sound of the band, we changed the label, and we changed the lineup of the band. Thor and Kimberly, who played on the last 12 records, or not 12 records, for the last 12 years we played together, played on the record, but they aren't touring with us right now. They're taking a break this year.
Oh, okay.
So we've got an entirely different lineup.
Oh, okay.
And it's much more of kind of a rock band. It's still... Or as close to that as we're ever going to get.
Well, it's a five piece, I think. Yes,
it is.
Yes, because I noticed that from the video. And is this? Do you find it actually challenging to reconfigure the band in this?
Yeah, it was definitely challenging. I mean, our drummer Danny was the engineer on the record, so he knew all the songs intimately by the time we'd finished the record. But it's been a lot of fun. I mean, it's you can't replace Thor or Kim. They're really special people. But you can do something different, and this is
the opportunity.
That's what this, that's what this band is.
Yeah. So why don't we actually play a song? Actually, let's listen to the song "Insolence" now, and then we can talk a little bit maybe about the songwriting style.
Okay. Yeah, that's my favorite one. That'd be great.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. So you're tuned to WGXC. This is Shearwater, the song "Insolence" from their new album, Animal Joy.
Thank you.
And that was Insolence from Shearwater's most recent release on the Sub Pop label called Animal Joy. And Jonathan Myberg is here in studio with us here at WGXC in our Hudson studio. We're having a brief conversation about things of interest, I hope. He's in town, obviously, because Shearwater will be playing tonight at Helsinki Hudson, 8 p.m. show. And he just mentioned to us that his friend Will Sheff, for whom he played with in Oklahoma River and in an early incarnation of Shearwater,
yep,
will be opening the show at
that's
Helsinki.
Right.
So that's an extra special reason why you should all get out there, if not for the fact that you would be contributing to the somewhat tiny coffers of WGXC. This is a benefit. Once the band makes its door minimum, 100% of the proceeds will be coming to WGXC. And I think that's a really worthwhile situation. And again, we offer our thanks to you for consenting to do
that. Oh, we're happy to do it. We really want to support you guys, and we're glad to be playing up here.
That's right. It's 8 o'clock tonight at Helsinki Hudson, just down the road on Columbia Street here. So let, in the context of Insolence or the other songs on the album, mm-hmm, a little bit about your songwriting style then. I gather that you draw on a wide variety of sources. I mean, in other interviews, you've mentioned musicians. I mean, there's the constant references to Talk Talk or Scott Walker in terms of your perhaps singing style at all. Mm-hmm. But do you have other, it seems like a sort of perhaps a silly question, but what other influences do you reach out to? I mean, is there books, art?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I get a lot of ideas just when I'm not on tour. It's the songwriting part of my brain kind of shuts down when we're touring usually. But last year I was lucky enough to get to spend a lot of time hiking out in southern Utah, actually, for a few weeks. And I feel like I got a lot of ideas for songs out there. And they come in not so much as like actual songs, so much as like just like a little feeling or a spark that you can then sort of tend when you get back to your crummy little rehearsal space in Austin or New York or whatever.
Right. You have a history of traveling, though. I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So that's nothing unusual to just be going out into the environment and picking up.
Yeah, but traveling and touring are different, which is something I had to learn over time. Because at first I got really frustrated by the fact that on tour I felt like I was never able to see anything. Like on this, you know, right now we're in the middle of playing 14 shows in 14 days, and we only had one other day off in the last few weeks. And, you know, like I never saw Montreal during the day for years. I've only seen it during the day one time.
Oh, really?
Because of the nature of the drive from Toronto to Montreal, and then you know, usually drive on in over the border that night. So once I started thinking about it as like a business trip that's really cool as opposed to traveling, it kind of started to change. But I don't do traveling on tour that you don't get to. You don't get to see people for long enough. You don't get to see places for long enough. It's sort of like the rest of the world is moving at light speed while you feel like you're in normal time. And so even though a week seems to have gone by for everyone else, a week on tour can seem like a month. I mean, just so many things happen.
Sure, sure. So do you ever find it difficult then to live up to whatever preconceived expectation there might be as to your erudite reputation as a songwriter?
Look, I'm just happy when people come to our shows. That's it. You know, if there are some people at the show tonight, I'll be happy. I don't think anybody's coming expecting a lecture from me.
No, not a lecture, but I think I definitely think you've established a reputation in terms of the material of Shearwater, both in its musical presentation and your lyrical presentation, of being slightly, you know, a slight step above I Want to Hold Your Hand, although there is a certain beauty and charm to that, and I don't mean to denigrate that. I'm just saying there's...
Well, it's funny. I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of things to think about in the world, and it's fun to try to think them out in song as well as in, you know, in essays or scholarly writing or whatever else you do. I mean, I was headed down the path of getting a PhD in biology for a while, and I pretty much had to stop and give that up in order to keep doing this, and that was a real kind of a crisis moment. It was very scary because I felt like that wasn't what I was supposed to do, or I wasn't sure. But ultimately, I just had to choose music and hope that was the right decision. I actually had a funny thing happen a couple of years ago. We played at South by Southwest, and we were loading off the stage as, you know, being pitched off, basically, like they always do with you at South by Southwest. The thing's the worst. And the and there was a guy standing there who looked really familiar to me, but I could not place him. And he's like, "Hi, Jonathan." I was like, "Who is that?" And he said, "It's Mike Ryan." And I realized he was the professor I was going to do my PhD with at UT when I bailed out of it. And he said, "I've been following your career, and I just wanted to say I think you really made the right decision."
Is that the left-handed compliment? No, no.
It was totally genuine, or okay. At least it seemed that way. I could have kissed him. I was just like, how often does that happen in life? You know, somebody turns up and says, "That was totally the right decision." It was great.
Wow.
But I have been able to keep my, you know, a few... keep my toe in the research world a little bit. Like, I'm going down to the Falklands in August this year to work with birds for a month, which will be a good break from touring.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, realistically, you know, see, that's what I'm saying. Not very many people would, you know, come in to do interviews talking about giving up their PhD research in biology and then saying they're going to take a month off to study birds in the Falklands. You do, you know, you stand apart from certain.
Well, I'm a musician who moonlights as a scientist. It's just
okay.
Sort of a,
there's a
sort of
right
a,
there. You go. That's a very nice way of describing it. Have you ever given thought to working with some of your influences? I mean, as we touched earlier, mentioning talk.
Like, would I like to meet Mark Hollis and work?
Well,
with?
I mean, actually, yes. I mean, I was wondering if you thought about the, you know, as you're with Kim and Thor not touring with you now.
Yeah.
If you ever thought to giving Paul Webb and Lee Harris, which is the
Orang,
to play with them or have Hollis produce you. I mean,
you know, I actually talked to Phil Brown, who recorded those last couple of Talk records, once about working together, and that might still happen someday. But it's so expensive to do anything in England, is really the problem. But I really admire those guys, but. Sometimes you don't want to meet the people whose work you really admire. Not because you're afraid they'll disappoint you personally, but just because the relationship you have to them, if it's really special to you, it's going to be best preserved if you never actually meet them.
Okay.
There are a few people I'd like to meet, but not that many of the ones whose work I really admire.
I was wondering if you would, Hollis had been described as actually just completely leaving the music industry and all, but a few years ago he produced
retired.
A record by a woman, Anya Gabarek.
Yeah, but I think he bailed out of that. I think he started working on it and then stopped.
Oh, all right.
You can see I'm enough of a stalker that I know what he's
doing. Yeah, this is very easy, because I've been listening to, I think it's the Smiling and Waving album, I think that's the one she did, and I hear certain things, I feel that there are certain things there that are very, for lack of a better word, Hollis-esque.
Yeah, well, I hope he comes back to music. I mean, I think he certainly had a lot to offer, but he may also feel like he's done what he had to do. And I'm not on the same trip as him. I find him very inspiring in a lot of ways, but he's not. I don't want to remake his records.
No. I would think more just as perhaps there's an interesting a meeting of somewhat sympathetic minds. I mean, and perhaps
when I first heard his music, I mean, it certainly I felt an identification with it that was really inspiring and kind of refreshing, especially because he has this very non-rock voice.
Yes,
which.
Oh.
You know, was what I ended up with also, and hearing him really doing what he could with that voice and finding something special that was all his own that he could do with it was inspiring to me and made me feel more confident in developing my own voice the way that I wanted to.
So as we get ready to wind up here, it's coming up on 4:30 at WGXC, Jonathan Myberg and from Shearwater here. I guess I would... ask you, do you still actually enjoy touring? Because you mentioned the difficulty in terms of, doing traveling and touring.
Yeah, I love this. I totally love it. And it's I feel very lucky to be able to do this job. I'm astonished that I'm able to still do it 10 years on. I have not yet given up.
You've been in music, though, for years before. I mean, you've been playing before audiences since I think you were in high school.
Yeah, for a long time.
Yeah.
Very badly for a long time and better recently. it takes a long time to get good at something, and I'm just now starting to get to the point where I feel like I feel confident enough to say that I'm good at it. It's like when the first time you write musician on your visa application, you're going to another country and you list your profession, your pen hovers over the page for a second, and you're like, M-U. It feels very consequential when you do that. but I feel lucky to have been chosen by this profession, and I hope I can keep at it for as long as I can. I wanted to say one other thing is that we're here with our good friend Nicholas Kahn, who lives here in town, who's worked on our album covers for the last three records. We've been really honored to work with him and his working partner, Richard Selesnik, and you're very lucky to have them here in your community. I mean, if it weren't for their efforts, we wouldn't be playing here tonight.
Then we're very lucky. But yes, so no.
Props to Nicholas.
Yes. Hudson is a very sweet little town. A lot of very interesting people coming by and doing